Hi, everyone. This marks our 10th episode of The World Unspun. We're so grateful to the thousands of you that have tuned into our podcast from 48 countries around the world. We've even been shortlisted for the Publisher Podcast Summit and Awards. We've got big plans for the future of this show, and we'll continue to bring you bi-weekly episodes with new guests and new formats. If you like what you hear, and you want to help other people to find us, please leave us a review in your podcast app. To keep on top of all of our work at New Internationalist, check us out at newint.org. Thanks again for tuning in. Now, on to the episode. Welcome to The World Unspun. I'm your host, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. You may not know them by name, but by the time you get up, turn on a device, or have your first cup of tea, you will have engaged with multiple critical minerals. 80% of the world is still powered by fossil fuels, but critical minerals are on the up. They have exotic names like indium, terbium, and gallium, and they're everywhere.
Critical minerals.
Critical minerals.
Critical minerals.
Critical minerals are vital for a host of industries.
Lithium, rare earth elements, nickel, copper.
But what exactly are critical minerals, and why all the hype? The term critical is the degree to which the minerals key to decarbonizing our energy future are considered economically or strategically important. This means it varies according to circumstances and viewpoint. Just how many of these materials are critical is up for debate. The US Geological Survey has identified 50. The International Energy Agency puts it at 37. The hype for these minerals comes from the fact that they are increasingly being used for all sorts of things. From electric vehicles, renewable energy, electricity storage and transmission, to digital communications, the medical sector, and the arms industry. Reserves of these minerals can be found in many countries around the world, but they are mostly sourced from the global south. And as you might have guessed, the mining companies that control critical minerals supply chains are primarily headquartered in the global north. But in recent months, the rush for critical minerals seems to have accelerated in a world that feels increasingly insecure and unpredictable.
We will drill, baby, drill.
So, to mark the launch of our latest magazine on critical minerals, we're digging deep. Over the next few episodes, we'll take you to Peru, Serbia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo to look at the ruthless greed and naked opportunism fueling the so-called green transition. More importantly, we'll share some smarter approaches. Stay with us.
Hello, I'm Vanessa Baird, and I'm a former co-editor of NI, and now I'm a contributing editor.
I spoke to Vanessa upon her return from South America, where she was reporting on the impacts of critical minerals mining in Peru and Chile.
So when I started looking into this, I had to explain to people what critical minerals were. And now, thanks to Donald Trump, most people have heard of them because they know that he's after them in Ukraine, in Greenland, and in numerous other places too.
And moments ago, I also signed an executive order to dramatically increase production of critical minerals and rare earths. And we spoke yesterday with, as you know, President Putin and President Zelensky.
Trump presents these minerals as the answer to all of our problems, and he wants access to them wherever they may be and by any means necessary. But it's not just the U.S. that is using these minerals as a political tool. China, too, has been limiting its critical mineral exports to the U.S. as trade tensions continue to escalate between the two countries. The reason these minerals have become so sought after is partly related to the need for a green transition. That's why the front cover of the magazine poses the question, can critical minerals save the world? I asked Vanessa what she thinks.
Well, behind that assumption is the idea that critical minerals are necessary or essential for the energy transition away from fossil fuels to far greater electrification. And so it has to do with generation of energy. For example, solar panels use them, wind power uses them, wind turbines use them, but also for transmission of electricity. For example, copper is a very important critical mineral and is used a lot for the transmission of all kinds of electricity everywhere, and also the storage of electricity in batteries, lithium, cobalt, and graphite are all key critical minerals for batteries. And half of the increase that we're going to need in critical mineral mining is actually going to go into batteries, etc., for electric vehicles.
In her research, Vanessa found that if today's rates of private car ownership are projected to 2050, EVs in the US alone would require 3 times the amount of lithium produced for the global market today. But this assumes that private car ownership will remain the dominant model to be replicated around the world. As Vanessa points out, it doesn't have to be that way. Not only can cars and their batteries be made smaller, but many would not have to be made at all if high-quality public transport systems were in place.
There's very little discussion of the model of transport whereby people have private cars carrying on as the dominant model, because if it does, we're going to have to mine so much in terms of critical minerals that it's going to create a lot of problems. Mining already creates a huge number of human rights and environmental issues. Then those people who are in the front line of mining, the people who, the communities that live in the areas where mining happens, are going to be even more under attack.
I've seen a lot of really slick ads from companies like BlackRock, especially on LinkedIn, popping up talking about how critical mineral mining can power the AI revolution and the low carbon transition.
We believe the price of copper, as well as other crucial materials, will rise over the coming years as infrastructure demand increases and as supply remains constrained. And this may provide amazing opportunities for investors in this area.
But in sort of looking at these with a critical eye, what are some of the biggest red flags and greenwashing tactics that people need to be aware of as this industry is set to get even more powerful and as some of these big players are set to capitalize on it?
Well, I think this issue of demand is very important, because one of the things that is ignored in all this is the use of water. That in order to mine, mining uses a huge amount of water. So does AI use a huge amount of water. So we're going to have, we already have an issue of water scarcity around the world. That's going to become very much worse. So that's one issue. And the other issue is the one I just touched upon, which is the issue of human rights and the, you know, just the extent of the amount of mining that's going to have to take place. Also, we have to bear in mind that these mining companies see an opportunity and they're going for it. So they present themselves really as the purveyors of the green revolution, if you like, because the mining companies can deliver these critical minerals. But they don't go into any kind of detail of the destructive impact of mining itself, the amount of water they're going to be using, and also the human rights issues that surround mining.
An important case study in the issue of critical minerals mining is in Peru, where the government of Dina Boluarte is determined to inflict a hated copper mining project on the people of the Tambo Valley.
Clashes in southern Peru. A 4,000 troop and riot police force deployed in the region of Arequipa. Since 2009, demonstrators have opposed Southern Copper Corp's project to exploit the hills surrounding the Cocachacra province. The Tambo Valley is at the heart of this protest.
An open-cast copper mining complex, Tia Maria and La Tapada, is planned for a site in the south of Peru, just 6 kilometers up the facing mountainside.
You approach it from a mountain road, a sort of more or less desert mountain, very arid desert mountain road. And when you get there, it's kind of, it almost hurts your eyes because it's so green. And this is a valley which is hugely fertile. They produce lots of different vegetables. They produce rice, they produce potatoes, they produce onions. And there is a river running through it, which really is a source of life for the people living there. So they're very proud agricultural community, and they know that once you put a mine next to such a community, and the plan is to put one of these mines only a couple of kilometers away and another one 6 kilometers up the hillside, that the mine is going to use the water, it's going to pollute the water, and that it will destroy their livelihoods.
The Tia Maria mine was first mooted and resisted over 15 years ago. Popular protests in 2011 and in 2015 were met with lethal violence from police and other government forces.
Riot police fired tear gas. Demonstrators wielded rocks at them. In more than 6 weeks, at least 3 people have died and hundreds have been wounded.
Farmer leaders of the Defense Front for the Tambo Valley paid a high price, receiving long prison sentences for their involvement in the protests. Some even fled into exile.
Some of them have lost their lives to it because in protests against the project, some of them were shot by police. So they have a lot of skin in this game.
3 successive Peruvian governments wrestled with what to do with the stalled mining project. Then in 2021, President Pedro Castillo declared Tia Maria a, quote, non-starter. The people of the Tambo Valley could breathe a sigh of relief, but it wouldn't last. Last year, the government of President Dina Boluarte announced that Tia Maria was back on the cards, and Vanessa says the local resistance has been spurred on once again. Cheering, farming, yes, mining, no. Protesters with the Defense Front movement say they're ramping up their efforts to stop the mine.
They're on an indefinite strike, which involves various protests around the place or in the neighboring domain, the capital of the region, which they've also launched a new legal action against the mine. Meanwhile, the government has given the mine a green light in all things, and construction work is due to begin in August.
Peru's Congress is controlled by a coalition of right-wing parties who chose Boluarte as their new leader after the overthrow of incumbent Pedro Castillo in December 2022. A lawyer with rural and indigenous roots, she's Peru's first female president. But since taking power, the unelected leader has shifted from an unconvincing moderate to right-wing neoliberal with an authoritarian edge. Now she wants Tia Maria to be part of her legacy. Last year, the Defense Front brought forth a legal case on the basis that environmental permits had expired. But these objections were overridden, and the then mining minister Romulo Mucho, who had interests in companies associated with the mine, gave it his strongest backing.
I've been talking about this for a while. How can the Tambo Valley be modernized? Above all, it requires comprehensive development of the Tambo Valley, but it needs a partner. Who is that partner? Tia Maria, of course.
Tia Maria is not the biggest copper project on the government's list for development or expansion, but it's symbolic. Here's José de Echave, the director of a Peruvian NGO that monitors mining conflicts and supports communities affected by mining.
Tia Maria has become an emblematic project. And the government's view is that if Tia Maria is successful, other controversial mining projects could follow. Projects like Tambo Grande and Conga and others. That's why there's a lot of interest in getting Tia Maria into production.
This government is very pro-mining, it's very pro-big mining. They really want to increase the revenues from mining, and they see the need for critical minerals as an opportunity to just go hell for leather.
The Ethical Shop is full of fair trade, organic and eco ideas, both for gifts and household goods. If you want to avoid Amazon and like the idea of trading more directly with a range of small suppliers, then come to us. We've got organic pasta from Essential Trading, fairly traded chocolate from Divine, a collection of unique greeting cards, plastic-free soap bars, and a whole range of Palestinian produce from our friends at Zaytun. What's more, the Ethical Shop exists to support the New Internationalist. head over to ethicalshop.org and give us a whirl.
But there's something else going on in Peru: the exponential rise in informal and illegal mining. As Vanessa points out in her piece, some 500,000 people work in this informal, sometimes called artisanal sector. That's more than double the number that work in conventional mining, mainly for multinational companies. They range from some of the poorest, most marginalized women scraping a living, to entrepreneurs earning enough to send their children to university abroad. But there is an important distinction between informal and illegal mining. The former is unofficial but not prohibited. The latter is carried out illegally in prohibited areas. Illegal mining has also become associated with violent criminal gangs. Informal miners are represented by a union called Confemin, and they want to be formalized. This should result in increased tax revenue, reduced criminality, more economic security for miners, and the application of environmental standards. But the model devised in Peru was so complicated and expensive that after 2 years, barely 2% of informal miners had completed the process. Still, Vanessa says that the union's activities and local protests against Tia Maria have inspired other movements elsewhere in the country. But in Peru's current political climate, this doesn't come without significant dangers. The Boluarte government already has a record for lethal repression of popular protest, with the killing of 50 civilians during protests in late 2022 and early 2023.
The government at the moment has shown that when push comes to shove, it will open fire on protesters. It did it in 2022 when Pedro Castillo was ousted and Dina Boluarte, the president Dina Boluarte, came to power. They showed then that they were quite ready to open fire on protesters. So it's a dangerous time. It's a dangerous time for protest. And it's a time when the political space is constantly being eroded with new laws to try and crush protest, to criminalize protest, and also now more recently and more alarmingly to try and stop the activities of NGOs who are trying to defend the rights of communities affected by mining to such an extent that even making critical comments about mining projects has been described as almost a terrorist act. It's a sort of strategy that has been used in Nicaragua, it's been used in Venezuela and Russia. So it's going to become harder and harder for those NGOs concerned about human rights and concerned about the environment to keep functioning in Peru. And very important that the international community keeps an eye on what's going on.
Hi, I'm Naomi Fowler. I make the Tax Justice Network podcast, The Tax Cast. Every month, I look at the latest stories on corruption, tax havens, and financial secrecy.
Concealing information is the name of the game.
$625 million is a serious contender for the biggest theft of all time.
Microsoft was able to shift $140 billion offshore.
We haven't started the war on dirty money.
We know fairer taxes and transparent financial systems change the world. On The Tax Cast, I talk to people on the front line.
It is crucial that we make progress towards international cooperation.
Tax havens have direct environmental costs.
These losses are responsible for so much excess inequality.
Join me and listen to The Tax Cast from the Tax Justice Network. We're available wherever you get your podcasts.
We got to be talking about taxes.
Given what we've discussed so far, what do you think is the most important takeaway from this case study in Peru as to responsible minerals, responsible mining that considers both people and planet, that takes into account these human rights issues that you've raised and that takes into account the environmental concerns that you've raised? Is there a way forward that is really more responsible?
There might be. It's very difficult to make mining responsible. It's impossible, I think, to make it green. The activity is quite environmentally destructive. And as the ore values go down, more and more earth has to be removed, more and more damage is done. But we need the minerals. Humans need minerals. You have got some examples and they are just a few and quite rare. For example, in some places in the Peruvian highlands, you've got communities which are campesino, they are farming communities, and they combine farming with mining, and they do it by having created a kind of mining farming company, and people in the community mine to some extent. Maybe they might spend 2 weeks of the month mining, and then they might spend 2 weeks of the month farming, and they try to do it in a way that is not going to destroy the local agriculture. So very possibly that might be a model. Mining can be done better, but I think responsible, maybe, but we don't see much of it.
Peru's politicians are gearing up for elections set to take place in 2026.
This government, this president, has got record levels of unpopularity. I think she has about 3% popularity approval ratings. Congress is similar. So there's a huge disaffection with the political system in Peru. There are about, I think, over 30 political parties registered for the forthcoming elections. And a lot of them are parties that we've never heard of before.
Vanessa says that while the current electoral candidates are unlikely to focus on developing a better model or protecting the environment from the excesses of mining, Peru's informal miners' union could provide a source of hope.
The informal miners have got a very powerful union, and they are a political force to be reckoned with. So I think watch that space, really.
That was Vanessa Baird, a former co-editor and now contributing editor of New Internationalist. You can read more of her reporting via the links in our show notes. In the next episode of this special mini-series, we're taking you across the pond to Serbia, where an anti-lithium mining movement has joined forces with other social movements across the country to fight for their land. You'll hear from Bojana Novaković, an actor and activist with Mars Sedrine, which supports local opposition to the multinational Rio Tinto mine, which could wreak havoc on land and livelihoods in Serbia.
We're not affiliated with any corporations or organizations, and definitely not affiliated with any political platform or political party, because our primary purpose is to preserve fertile soil and nature, biodiversity in the Jadar Valley. This has led us to be able to speak to people, listen to people, hold space, and also then that leads to other people holding space for us.
Don't miss it. That's it for now. If you were inspired by what you heard today and want to read more of our reporting on critical minerals, subscribe to New Internationalist to read our latest issue in full. Check out our show notes, where you'll find a link to subscribe, and don't forget to use the code THEWORLDUNSPUN at checkout for 20% off the first year of your print and or digital subscription. This episode was hosted and produced by me, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist. Co-editors of the magazine are Amy Hall, Bethany Riley, Conrad Landon, and Nick Dowson. Our editorial assistant is Paula Lacey, and Vanessa Baird is the contributing editor of our latest issue. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Fuz. Audio editing is by Nasik Hamza. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.